Hello, and welcome to Preprints in Motion. This is the only show bringing you the freshest science directly from the hottest new scientists. So join us as we discuss science, preprints, and academia. So hit that subscribe button and join us every first and third Wednesday for a brand new episode, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. But for now, let's get into the show. Welcome to the first special episode. This week we discuss one of the major preprint platforms, Research Square, with Editor-in-Chief Michelle Avisar-Whiting.
So today on the show we have Michelle Avisar-Whiting, who is the Editor-in-Chief of Research Square, and I have a lot of questions on my little sheet that we use. So I think we'll be sensible and start somewhere that makes sense. Why don't you give us a quick overview of what Research Square is?
Sure. I guess it's more of a loaded question than you probably realize. The short, easy answer is that Research Square is a preprint platform. But the more accurate answer is that the preprint is really only one aspect of what we hope will become kind of an entire manuscript preparation ecosystem for authors. That's the aspiration. When we started this thing in 2018, we started out calling it a pre-publication platform, which has a lot of alliteration and is really long and got tiresome to say, and nobody knew what it meant. And so eventually we kind of dropped it because nobody wants to say pre-publication platform over and over again. And we didn't really want people to see us as simply throwing in with a trend and creating a superfluous preprint server that didn't serve any additional purpose above, you know, and beyond what BioArchive and MedArchive were already offering. So it wasn't meant to be just a new preprint server, but really a new category. Where the mission was aligned with the enduring mission of the company as a whole, which is to help researchers everywhere in the world reach their publication goals.
So wholesome.
It is. It's really true, too. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the company, Research Square, the company is an outgrowth of the 17-year-old-ish company called American Journal Experts, which is primarily an English language editing company specializing in academic manuscripts. So this was the spirit that we carried through to how the platform was conceived. We already knew of multiple ways that we can help authors in the early stages of manuscript preparation. And now that research is increasingly being shared earlier than ever, we can also help them with that. So that's how this whole project formed.
And you are kind of touching upon my next question there, which is, how is Research Square different from the other platforms? Because to look at, very different. But there's a few things you guys do that, you know, BioArchive, for example, doesn't do.
Probably the most important way that we're different from BioArchive, if you just want to make that direct comparison, is that in addition to having a direct submission route, the way that anyone would submit to a preprint to BioArchive, our platform is also integrated as a service into the submission process of now nearly 500 journals. And they're all journals in the Springer Nature portfolio. Springer Nature is majority investor in our company. So practically what this means is that authors who are submitting original research to one of those journals are presented with the option to post their manuscript as a preprint on Research Square while it's under consideration at the journal. Or even if it's not under consideration, if it drops out early, if they opt into this service, then they have a preprint and it's permanent. And anywhere from 25 to 35%-ish of authors opt into that, depending on the journal. Different journals have different opt-in rates.
So does that mean most of your preprints are coming from that route, or are people still kind of posting them up first?
Most of the preprints on our platform have come from that route. And beyond the journal integration aspect, I should note that we're one of only a few commercial preprint platforms. We have a business model that I alluded to in the first answer. So we're trying to leverage the decade and a half of expertise that we've accumulated as a manuscript services company and work that in as a business model, because of course preprints are free. There's not a lot of money to be made from preprints alone. So the hope is that authors can not only benefit from getting a free preprint at the point of publication, be offered a suite of tools, third-party integrations, services that help them with everything from grammar and quality checks to journal selection and promotion, even promotional services. So this is why I called it a new category a minute ago. It's not the The point is not just to say, great, you have a preprint, call it a day. Of course, that's fine if all authors hope to gain from it is the preprint. But we know that there are other ways we can offer support.
So do you get more diverse people submitting to you guys then? Because I imagine if you're offering these extra services, you're going to get people who maybe, you know, their first language might not be English, for example, because that's a bit more helpful.
Loads. Yeah. I mean, the representation of the preprints on Research Square is probably pretty in line with the representation of people submitting to journals. Think about the entire, you know, cohort of individuals that submit papers to Springer Nature to say the BMC series. We're getting 30% of those overall, right? So there's a lot more representation, for example, from China than I would guess BioArchive has.
Well, I looked at that very recently. And yeah, so most of BioArchive and MedArchive, their papers are primarily the UK and the US. China's third at the moment, but that's largely COVID-driven, or it looks like it's largely COVID-driven. But then there's some interesting peaks in that. So if you look at places like India, there's a massive spike in terms of submissions, again, COVID-related from India. But yeah, that is very skewed. BioArchive is very Western skewed, I think, at the moment.
Yes, very true.
Okay, so still on the sensible questions, but you were not always in publishing. You started out as a postdoc, and part of the people we're trying to target with this podcast when we're not doing these episodes are early career researchers, so primarily postdocs and PhD students, a lot of whom I can probably say with confidence are not overly happy in their current jobs. So why did you leave the bench? What was that a positive decision, or did you decide just academia was not great?
Turned out to be a positive decision. I couldn't have known that at the time. I think Richard Sever recently posted something about this, that he's never spoken to anybody who's regretted their decision to leave academia. That's been my experience as well. I don't know, you know, that's N of two, but I had a great time at the bench and was very lucky to have a wonderful mentor. And I published well in grad school and as a postdoc. But I found myself just feeling totally beaten down by the failure rate of science. You work so hard chasing an idea, and then the Western just fails again and again and again. And you discover that the antibody was crap, so you order a new one and it still doesn't work. And these experiments take 2 or 3 days apiece. And then it just, you know, even if it does replicate, well, that was just one step in a long series of other experiments, and each one just leads to another question. There's never an ending point to it. So I found myself, and it's both a beautiful thing and a really depressing thing about science. You know, it's great that every answer begets another question. That's the whole point. But I just found myself like fantasizing about being a builder and like getting the plans to build a house and just building it, and then the family moves in and you get to be done with that project and move on to a completely new one. It's that sense of finality that I was totally missing. I guess that's what publications are meant to provide, but it just doesn't feel the same. Yeah. Publishing the paper, we never celebrated as much as we should have. It's what punctuates that long trip through failed experiments and writing that narrative that you hope ties it all together. And hey, maybe some of it is even true, you hope. More to come on that, I guess. But yeah, I think that's what it was for me. I couldn't get used to the failure rate. I wanted to do something that felt more, I guess, immediately rewarding. It probably has more to do with my personality. I have a ton of respect for people who fight that fight through research careers.
They're all crazy. They've got to be crazy.
They are.
So what does your day-to-day look like now then? I presume it's very, very office-based. I can't imagine you get out to chat to people about the papers all that often.
No, I don't, unfortunately. So my day-to-day, I guess I always try to have one writing piece or talk that I'm preparing in progress. Like, I'm kind of, part of my remit is to be a thought leader. And so I'm trying to think hard about things and say something original once in a while. So that is, you know, a goal of my everyday. But a big part of my job is just doing consultations on preprints to make sure that what we're posting is safe for human consumption. So I, you know, part of my role is just to have the final say, to set the policies by which our screening is all done in-house. It's another distinction between us and BioArchive that have, you know, this affiliate network that they use. We do it in-house. I train these folks. I'm the one that gives them the direction around how we make these decisions, but sometimes it's hard to make a decision. And so those papers will come to me. And I have the fun task of deciding whether, you know, to put our reputation on the line by putting this paper out there or hold back and be a little more conservative. So that's a lot of what I do. I'm also kind of nominally on the product team at work. And I don't know how many people have in academia and your audience will have a sense of what that is, but it's the, you know, the team that drives the product, and the product is the platform. You know, that is the product that we are selling in a sense. And so we are constantly working on improving it and picking up feedback from researchers mostly to understand what it is they're trying to get out of our platform and trying to make those improvements, working with the engineering team to do that. And then there's, you know, blog content. I've been managing the blog for Research Square. So I commission that content sometimes from researchers, sometimes just from our staff and other people in the industry, and keeping up with Twitter.
Full-time job.
It's a full-time job. I mean, you really can lose hours in a day to just trying to keep up with whatever the last, I don't know, train wreck was in science that you want to make sure that you're apprised of.
So that's probably a good jumping off point too. So you do all of your screening in-house. Could you explain what that screening actually is and what it, because I think a lot of people have this notion that preprint servers allow you to just post anything, which isn't, as far as I'm aware, isn't true for any of the servers. But could you just explain what checks you have in place?
There may be servers that take a much more lax approach. Yeah. I don't know that there are any that just post anything, but I know that there are some that really consider themselves more, I won't name any names, consider themselves more repositories than preprint servers. And I hope that the term preprint server can become synonymous with a organization that does take some responsibility for what they're putting. And we bellyache a lot about what we put up on the site. And what goes into it is mostly just making sure that what gets posted is not going to pose any potential threat to human health, either to individuals or to groups, result any kind of weird social contagion about an idea that we really don't want people to trace back to us. And, you know, keeping pseudoscience to the extent that we can recognize it off of the platform. I think those are the main things. Making sure that papers are adhering to ethical norms would be another one. So we have our own kind of set of criteria, and making sure that, you know, identifiers don't appear on preprints. Weird little nuance that not everybody appreciates is that having a person's face, a patient's face or name or something in a manuscript could actually be okay for the purposes of review or peer review. But this person did not necessarily consent to having their face all over a public platform. So there's a consideration for that. And we do post case reports, so we have to be extra careful with those studies. This is another distinction between us and BioArchive. There are certain studies that we agree to post that I think that they've mostly stayed away from.
Yeah, I think they're certainly for the MedArchive stuff, their screening is fairly robust, I think, these days. Because they started almost just before the pandemic. So I think there was a lot of conscious decision going into what they would actually put up for there, which I think is probably a good thing. So your initial stance towards preprints and open science, you said, was not favorable. So what was your initial stance?
I don't think it was particularly unusual. I guess I'll start with the open access movement in general, which was just starting to pick up steam when I was in grad school. I think PLOS One launched in my first or second year. It was just viewed very skeptically by a lot of people in my own circles. I don't think we would have considered publishing in PLOS One at that time. You know, that there was this notion that I think that made it kind of very quickly associated it with predatory practices, this notion of covering one's own costs for publication. And it still is, you know, I'm kind of surprised by how much of this notion still persists, maybe not so much in the US or the UK. But I gave a talk in Italy. It wasn't really in Italy. I was zooming in, unfortunately. And one of the questions that I was talking about, open access, and one of the unintended consequences of it was the rash of predatory publishers popping up. And this guy at the end, an agriculture researcher, said that he really views all open access publishers as predatory. And this was like a few months ago. So that was really surprising to me. I thought we had come a long way. And, you know, it's possible that he's an outlier. But I do think that OA is still trailing some weird perceptions about quality that are probably unfair at this point. They've really probably had to work harder to demonstrate super high levels of integrity in their practices in order to win trust and, you know, instate their editorial prowess or whatever. So there are probably lots of examples of open access journals that are operating at a much higher level of integrity than many subscription journals at this point. So I don't think it's fair, but I was subject to that kind of bias, I guess, coming out of grad school, and was sort of disabused of it joining my company, because we've always had a very favorable stance toward open access. Our whole like raison d'être is to help remove barriers for researchers, and this was a major one. And I saw the light pretty quickly with that.
Yeah, I am amazed. So I spend a lot of time talking to a lot of Mercury researchers, and it always shocks me that they still seem to have issues with things like PLOS One or preprints. And I just don't understand it at all. I mean, my circle is increasingly pro preprint, so maybe I'm just in a bubble.
I think I'm the same way. Preprints was, even after I'd accepted open access, when I first heard about preprints, before I ever got involved with this project, it totally rocked my world. And how could you just put this paper online without any peer review? And it just took a lot more thought about, I don't know, kind of deepening cynicism about the system and really listening to people's position on this and why this is actually the better route. But I do understand the pushback about it. And I think I have to, in order to have the job that I have, right? Like I have to understand why people are pushing back so that I can offer good rebuttals to those objections. Even I reserve a level of skepticism about it. You know, this project has only kind of recently started, and maybe in 20 years we'll find that, you know, this was a mistake or something. You know, as a scientist, I'm never just so deeply convinced that I'm right about anything, and have to be constantly challenging my own assumptions about it. But so far, what I'm finding is that, you know, the burden of proof is now on the people who are saying this is going to destroy everything. This is going to lead to a lot of, you know, people dying, and, you know, all the kinds of fear mongering that's gone on about it. I haven't seen that bear out. And so, you know, I actually just published an article on Scholarly Kitchen yesterday. It's kind of apropos.
It's in my question.
Oh, good.
I read that last night.
Yeah, and it's Scholarly Kitchen, so I guess it's to be expected. But you can see some of the comments trending in a certain direction. And so there are holdouts still on this. And they're saying, you know, you have to come with the data to show us that this is safe. Well, I can't do that. Like, you have to show me that it's not safe. Like, where is the evidence of that? Or that it's much, much less safe than the traditional system?
Well, that's the stick I'm currently beating everyone I come across with. Because there is now a growing body, and I wrote about this last month, there is a growing body of evidence that is showing that, at the very least, preprints are comparable to the published literature. And I've yet to see any evidence against that. Scholarly Kitchen's a really good example. People on there will often say a lot of different claims about preprints. Maybe they're not very good quality. They let charlatans through. And yes, there's always going to be those people who do get through, but you find plenty of examples of those in the published literature. But there's nothing, I've yet to see anything that says they're actually bad or harmful. There's no evidence, as far as I'm aware, for that. But there is evidence that they're good and they help
right. A
lot of people, actually.
You know, it's just like everything you're told when you're younger, you eventually find out is not as straightforward as it originally, you know, presented. And, you know, as an undergrad, I definitely fully bought into the story about journal peer review being just an unmitigated good for science, that nothing published could possibly be trusted without it, and that anything that has been reviewed is effectively past some like fixed threshold of rigor that meant it could be trusted. And in reality, what you learn is that the structures that govern scientific publishing are subject to the same strange dynamics of politics, abuses of power, cronyism, as all other closed systems. And, you know, even aside from those types of abuses, it's just not an honest exercise in assessing the quality of work. The outcome of that is exactly as you'd expect, right? Like, many cases, to say that peer review greatly improves the rigor or quality of the study or ensures its veracity in some, you know, like in any sense, is an overstatement. And in some cases, just a total fiction.
Yeah. I would love to look at how much money is spent on the experiments to answer the reviewer comments and that side of things to see if we're actually, if it is just this huge money waste. Because so the evidence we did as a group and others have done shows that the key conclusions don't change much. But what we do find is that you might have a more robust conclusion. But is that robust, slightly more robust conclusion worth, you know, 50,000 extra being spent, or a postdoc not getting their job because they didn't publish in time?
Do you mean that it's a more robust conclusion in that it's more robustly supported by the evidence in the final version, or that it's just stated in a more...
So more generally, it was more robustly supported by the evidence. So you might have an increase in N number, or you might have more than one method showing the same thing, which I think anyone should be doing that anyway, really. Yeah. That's just good science.
Yeah.
So we still need some rigor in the system. And I think I assume this is it. I'm asking this. So should we remove peer review completely?
No, I don't think so. I think we need to disassemble it somewhat and probably eventually move it away from journals as we think of them right now. I know it's a really controversial take, but there's just something problematic about the notion that an editor will be able to pick out exactly the right people to adjudicate on a study. When you put research out there, the people who find it first, because they're looking for it, those are the people that should be reviewing it. The problem is that incentivizing that right now is completely impossible. Like, you know that preprints don't get comments, you know, almost ever. It's really poorly utilized. The idea of post-publication review right now is still very new. And those systems that are in place to review preprints are not being utilized like to the extent that we would hope, right? Because there's such a force on the other, you know, there's so much demand from the journal side of things to do that work for the journals. So this is a flip that's going to take probably decades. But when it happens, I think it will be amazing, because you'll end up with, you know, the people who are the most well positioned to talk about the study right there on the preprint talking about it.
We've seen the pandemic has helped, I guess, shift that a little bit. We've seen new services come up that doing this kind of post-publication review. A lot of people are now targeting certainly postdocs to do reviews, whereas before we were kind of a bit of a left out group. Although, message to all postdocs and PhD students, put your email addresses out there, please, which is kicked off on Twitter the other day. How do we incentivize these kind of things? Because I can't imagine a situation where any journal is willing to pay peer reviewers, which kind of leans it more towards it needs to be something that is considered for funding and job applications, because then we've got an incentive to actually do review more, which is totally separate from transparent review, of course. But how do we get people to do that? Because at the moment you do it because it's kind of, you feel good initially, and then it just becomes a burden that you've got to keep doing.
Right. I don't think it's us that needs to do it. People talk a lot about these grassroots movements to, let's all just decide that we're going to start doing reviews on preprints. And these are like little tiny groups in the West that end up looking like they're completely disconnected from reality. And they are, because it's the institutions that drive these behaviors, right? And so until they incentivize it in some way, I have very little hope that these things can change. And it's the same question about just the other bad behaviors that happen around metrics and gaming metrics and citation metrics, which I've also given a talk about, so it's fresh in my mind. The change is going to have to come from the institutional level, because we can't rely on people's just pro-social tendencies. Even though I feel like we've all just decided to follow this or be part of this collective delusion. We all, at least the scientists, none of us have any illusions about what very few of us have illusions about what peer review really does accomplish for us and journal peer review. And yet we all just keep playing this game as though it's a lot, you know, as though it is this sort of beacon of truth, or, you know. And I think it's just because the incentives are aligned that way. And I know Talia Coney will push back on that with his thesis on it's not the incentives, it's you. Fair enough, but that just assumes that we have enough people that will come to the conclusion that they're just going to behave better regardless of the incentives. And I just don't know, maybe I have less faith in humanity than that. But I, for myself, I'm not sure that I would be compelled to, well, screw it, I'm not going to support this system anymore because I know all the problems with it. And so I'm going to behave this way, even though I know that 99% of other people will continue to benefit from, from the structures that we've set up.
I mean, yeah, if you go against it, you're the one who loses out ultimately with the way academia works. You can't go against it.
It's not fair to ask people to do that, and especially, you know, early career researchers.
Yeah. I mean, I maintain that the only way it's going to get fixed is when we kick out all those people at the top who are supposed to be leaders, but they're not, and replace them with people who are actually willing to say we need to do changes. And I don't know if that will ever happen, because I think part of the way you get to the top is by being part of the system. And then once you get there, the system worked for you, so it works. Why? That's your thinking, right? But yeah, I think that's what's needed. And we're very, very slowly seeing change there.
Yes.
So in the UK, the UKRI, who's our big sort of funding body, they've recently started up to invite early career researchers onto various different panels and decision-making platforms. Not anywhere near the top where we need them, but it's a slow start.
I'm given hope by some of these initiatives like DORA and the work done by the Center of Open Science, defining new metrics that are much harder to game. They do give me hope that more of this is coming. There's a lot of signatories to those kinds of initiatives. I mean, not all of them actually adhere to the tenets of the initiatives, but this is also where Twitter, as I don't want to like be too much of a spokesperson for Twitter, because I do think it's really toxic.
They're not funding us.
Good, so. Perfect. I do think it's a very toxic place in general, and it's beaten me down a little bit too. But it is useful for revealing abuses of power and instances where people are attempting to take advantage of some pro-social movement, but in reality continuing to operate in the laziest and most self-serving fashion possible. Yeah. Twitter people either anonymously or not anonymously call those things out. And it's been, I think, really eye-opening. It's pushing things along. I agree it's slow, but we've certainly made progress from where we were 10 years
ago. Yeah, I think Twitter is a really good platform to constantly push, because it is something that kind of levels the playing field a little bit. It gives people who wouldn't normally get a voice. And you can, again, we're probably going to get sued now, but I'm going to bring up Michael Levitt again. So Michael Levitt, just for anyone who's listening who's not familiar with what has been happening mainly on Twitter, Michael Levitt has been woefully wrong about COVID so far, but he's using his platform as Nobel Prize winner to push his views. And recently, there was a really, really good preprint. I think it was posted on Archive in January. And in that, a PhD student who was the first author looked at how disinformation has been spread during the pandemic. Really important work, quite well done work. Interesting preprint. Go and read it. But in one line, in the middle of this work, she mentions Michael Levitt by name. And as a response, Michael Levitt decided to tweet about that and call her out very publicly, which he shouldn't be doing in the first place, but it's such an abuse of power. And given the context that Michael Levitt has also been trying to have funding removed or have people fired from their positions, it's quite, I think, a dangerous thing. So the question that arises out of that really is, what can we do as early career researchers to try and push for change? Because if we do something scientific, someone there is being called out very publicly in a dangerous manner. I should say it, Twitter backlash against Michael Levitt was great. That was very heartwarming to see. But, you know, we're in a position where our careers depend on the person above us more than almost anything else. So how do we fight against that? Is there anything we can do?
I don't think I have a great answer for that.
It's a difficult
question. I do think just that we have to have the honest conversations in the light of day. You know, this is why I keep saying Twitter, because it just happens to be where those conversations are happening. But they're also happening on PubPeer, and they're happening other places where what we have a commitment to truth at the end of the day. And if we keep establishing and reestablishing that that's what we're interested in, and that we're not, you know, interested in and taking down, I think maybe that's just not the right approach. Like, we want to take down all of the, there, like you said, there are good people at the top too who really are fighting for the ideals that we're talking about here. So a wholesale takedown of power structures, I don't think is necessarily the right approach. Just a commitment to the fundamental aspects that we care about, that we should all care about as scientists, right? And if anyone speaks out against those, then they look really bad. But, you know, when you start attacking individuals, it gets really hairy really quickly. So we get back to the fundamentals and say what we're interested in is the truth, and take take things apart in very systematic. I've seen this being done all over Twitter, really amazing intellectual debates about specific points in science. I mean, we have to get down to the core issues that we're talking about, right? Like the debate is about some specific, or, you know, conversation about molecular biology, then you have that conversation, not the kind of overarching conversation about, well, you shouldn't be in power because you have a Nobel Prize, or, you know, you shouldn't, that shouldn't, afford you the right to impose your belief system, which is what it comes down to, is a belief system, and not one something that's based in evidence. We just keep asserting our commitment to evidence-based argumentation, then we can probably make more headway that approach.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons I started up the COVID work I was involved with earlier, with looking at preprints, because I kept seeing these people say preprints were bad and I couldn't find any evidence for it. So I thought, why don't we go out and look at it? And I, to be honest, I didn't really know what to expect. So at least I went in with it somewhat objectively.
I appreciate your work on that. It definitely helps helps make my arguments when I need to.
There's an excellent team effort. I had very little to do with it. So whilst we're talking about pandemic stuff, how has COVID impacted Research Square? I assume you've seen a huge influx of preprints and articles.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I took this role in June of 2020.
That was brave.
Was pretty stupid. And it's like at the primary editorial stakeholder and also the voice of the platform at a time when we were 3 months into a pandemic. But to be honest, I was already leaning into that role earlier in the year when things started getting wild, and we were suddenly seeing this influx of papers about the virus, and like everyone else, we just had to stumble our way around in the dark trying to figure out what the right thing to do at every given point was. Like preprints were already new, and now there's this new virus. So there was already like an ongoing debate about, are preprints even safe for public consumption? How are we deranging the information landscape by putting papers out that haven't been subject to any real scrutiny? And so the COVID pandemic just really resulted in a lot of rethinking, I think, with like the other servers about the prominence of our disclaimer and, you know, our entire approach to screening, actually, how we communicate those policies and decisions externally. And the challenge of preprint screening has always been about kind of balancing that commitment that we're making to post research without really adjudicating on the methodological rigor or its potential, certainly not on its potential importance to the field. But we have to balance that with the imperative to stay vigilant with respect to, potential misinterpretation or misuse that could result in negative consequences for people. So suddenly we were tasked with being the first line of dissemination from brand new findings on this virus that had the entire world at its mercy. And we're doing the math on, you know, is this information more likely to help or harm right now? And how urgent is it actually? So that's kind of how it felt, you know, being in that position at that time. And it was kind of trial by fire. We learned a lot. This was pretty much like the worst set of circumstances to figure out how to do this new concept of publishing. It was good in a sense, because it's going to inform a lot of how we do things from here on out, right? Like we'll be ready the next time a virus either zoonotically escapes or is leaked from a lab.
Hopefully we'll have better governments in place that time.
Yeah, that would help.
They might not spread so much.
Definitely.
So I know BioArchive, MedArchive managed to maintain their sort of 2-day turnaround for preprints after. How did you cope with that? Did you have to hire more staff, or were you able to just kind of take on that extra workload?
We had to scale up our staff, mostly to handle not so much the screening bit, because that's pretty quick, but the actual production work on a preprint isn't trivial. You know, we're, you know, sectioning it and making it look like kind of like an article, and figure handling, file handling, it's a lot of work that goes into it. So we definitely had to scale up, and our turnaround time certainly slowed down during that time. We did try to prioritize direct submissions to the platform. Part of the reason being that, you know, preprints that come in from the Springer Nature submission, you know, cohort are often held up by other things like journal processes, right? So it'll sometimes take weeks before it even gets to us for posting a preprint. But the direct submissions are the ones that are more comparable to what BioArchive is doing, and that's when it becomes really noticeable if we're being slow. And I know it just was so imperative at that time to get the research out quickly. So we tried to maintain, similar to BioArchive, two to 3 days turnaround on direct submissions.
Which is quick, very quick.
It is, yeah, especially relative to the people had become accustomed to.
So one of the things we've seen with the pandemic is if you look for previous years, the percentage of the literature that is preprinted is sort of 3 and a bit. I think it's just under 4% of the literature is preprinted for biomedicine. Whereas last year it was, I think, 8.5% of the literature. So we've seen a doubling. Do you think that is here to stay? Do you think people are going to continue using preprints now that have come, that are perhaps new?
Yeah, I think the support from publishers should certainly be an indication that preprints are kind of going to become a standard part of the publication workflow. And that's what I expect is going to happen over time. You know, it also indicates a willingness, or maybe capitulation by publishers, to let go of at least their role as originators and providers of content. I think, you know, certainly Springer Nature, I think, has been very progressive in this sense. They were, at least the Nature Publishing Group, was requiring that people deposit a preprint when they were publishing on COVID during the pandemic. I thought that was a few other publishers followed suit then, right? Just really recognizing the importance of just getting this information out there and understanding that the assessment piece can wait. So, I think there will be a shift from that traditional role as the content provider to maybe a doubling down on their investment of their role as a gatekeepers has a negative valence to it. So I won't use that.
Curators,
and the certifiers of the content. You know, I think that's what journals hope to provide, and you know, hopefully they can start getting creative and start thinking clearly about where the money should go. Should it be toward high production value and consistently formatted references or standardized checks, you know, that really speak to the rigor and transparency of the paper, and maybe toward compensation for high quality peer review. Like, these are all areas that I think, you know, the more progressive publishers certainly have on their radar. So can we start to think about a journal article as really the certified final version of the preprint? Yeah, in my ideal world, yes. Okay. It would look more like the overlay model of a journal. So I think the preprint shift will allow for some refocusing on the part of publishers and put some new creative solutions on the table, hopefully.
Oh, yeah, hopefully. One of the things, we're in similar circles on Twitter, so you've probably seen this, but one of the recent things to come up was transferring reviews from journal to journal, or publishing reviews after you've had them transferred. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? What is transparent peer review something we should always aim for?
I think that should be the North Star. I realize there are a lot of complicating issues with it. If by transparent peer review, you mean fully transparent and signed peer reviews, and or I don't know if you do, but certainly transparent, I guess the I would put the imperative on it being transparent, that it is coupled to the paper so that you can see alongside any paper or preprint or journal article, sort of the circumstances under which this piece of writing was either not accepted at a journal or accepted, you know, sort of endorsed by a journal. This is a piece that we're missing with most journal articles out there, right? And it's we're increasingly understanding how much of a missing piece that actually is for context.
I'm a bit on the fence as to whether or not reviews should be signed. I think there's good arguments against doing that as well as doing that. I think they should be accountable at least to the journals and the editors, but maybe not publicly signed. I think that might be too, certainly for early career researchers, might be a bit dangerous to do.
And not now, perhaps. Like, this is maybe something that we should aspire toward, because the culture of peer review is probably not ready for that. And all those power systems that we were talking about, you know, are not, you know, the hope is that we'll get to a place where an ECR can be very, very frank and transparent about their criticisms about a paper and respectful. I mean, we expect the same level of discourse and respect from all levels of the hierarchy, I guess is the right word, that, you know, hopefully we can get to a place where we can have conversations happening from the top to the bottom, the bottom to the top, that are focused on the science and don't allow egos to get in the way too much, because we, you know, externally are just holding everyone to this standard. I do think that's possible to do. But I know it's been a debate around eLife recently, you know, how they're handling those preprint reviews for the papers that don't ultimately get published. And I think, you know, what they're doing here is super important, because we're trying something. We're just saying, you know, shutting it out right out of the gate because we have assumptions about why it won't work. We have to try.
eLife are a really good journal for sort of pushing and trying things. I'm hoping Michael will come on and chat to us at some point. We're also in the same Twitter circle, so he should.
He definitely should.
If he listens, then there you go. He's got you now. Because if he doesn't, it's just rude and everyone knows.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CD, XY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.
I can probably go ahead and maybe ask my question that I had. It might not be, so I'm not as up to date on preprint stuff as Johnny is, but obviously there's a lot of talk about negative data. Are preprints, do you think, a way and should be a way and could be a way to kind of get that out, the negative data? Because obviously it doesn't have to be chosen specifically. I just wondered what your view on that was.
Yeah, I think it's a really important piece of what preprints are hoping to solve, because of course there's just been, we're on the back of decades of positive, you know, results, publication bias, and that's been terrible, I think, for science as an institution. One of the beauties of everything being digital is that there's no reason to hide what doesn't work, especially if it's done at, you know, at a really high standard of rigor and with, you know, a really high level of reporting, reaches really high level of reporting standards. This can be super useful for someone who is in that field and wants to see sort of the full picture of what experiments have been done and which have failed.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
So let's get on to the article you wrote that appeared yesterday in the Scholarly Kitchen. Some of the stuff in there is really, you've got some really good examples of preprints that you had to either remove or are questionable. And certainly during the pandemic, we've seen a lot of those highlighted a lot by the general public or far-right media or presidents. You know, I'm not going to name any presidents, but they've been involved. So could I guess it would be really good just if you could give us maybe an example of one where you've had to step in and take action, how you did that.
Yeah, and this speaks to my earlier point about, you know, preprints being accessible to anyone. And so the people that are the most interested in or the closest to the study are going to be the ones that probably look at it first and certainly look at it the most closely. And what that means is that they're also in a good position to find strange things, including instances of misconduct. And I mean, these things would just never have come to light. The things I mentioned in the article, many of them, you know, the best reviewer, the best editor out there wouldn't be able to spot these things because it wasn't their paper that was ripped off or and so it's just something that surprised me, I guess. I wasn't thinking of this as a potential value proposition for preprints, is that it, you know, allows for seeking these things out when they otherwise would get probably all the way to publication. And then, you know, if they get published in a subscription journal that isn't read, that isn't well read, possible that it would just never be caught.
Even if it was caught, one thing I have noticed that preprint servers are really good at is they were very quick at removing things or at least flagging things up. Whereas anyone who follows Elizabeth Bick will know you can report things to journals and it takes years before they do it, if they do anything.
If at all, yeah. Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, I am sort of hoping that there'll be more focus on preprints among those, Dr. Bick and others like her who are doing such important work. But even that, they, you know, like won't always be able to find those issues because, again, you know, it's the people that are, in some cases, I had, I think, an example in there about figure plagiarizing. This is something that I don't think people consider even really, that you think of plagiarizing, you think of text plagiarism, but it happens in other ways. And that being able to just lift someone's graphs and change colors and, you know, change some things subtly would never be, you know, I don't think there it will be a long time before we see software that can pick up on anything like that. We do have Authenticate to pick up on plagiarism, you know, text plagiarism. Something like that is just, you know, we can dream about it. But the person who did that study is going to look at it and immediately recognize, like, this is bizarrely close to my work. And even if, you know, even if there was no real text plagiarism to speak of, this is still a serious breach of conduct. So yeah, this is, you know, and we can, like you said, this allows us to catch it early before it ever, you know, gets sort of endorsed by a journal, which you can't even, we can only put so much expectation on journals to find these kinds of problems, because I really do think it's impossible in many cases. Paper mills are another one like that. So the fact that we can catch them early and get them marked in some way, you know, we very, very rarely will take a preprint down fully without any sort of trace, but most of them will be marked, you know, to indicate that there's been some ethical concerns brought up. And I've been thinking about how to deal with this, you know, more recently, because we have an example of one preprint on the platform that is under investigation at the journal in which it was ultimately published. And so, you know, it seems like there needs to be some indication on the preprint as well, because it's almost the exact same paper, right? And we do link to the version of record wherever we can. So this is kind of a new territory for us. For looking, I think we need to make sure that we're recapitulating the story on the journal article. If they're saying that it's under investigation, that there may be some problem with it, then that needs to translate all the way down to the preprint as well. We need to notify. So now I have this new concept of an editorial note where, you know, I can mark the preprint to indicate that something might be going on upstream of the preprint.
So what do you do with, because the journals don't always say something is under review, they might do that internally. So I mean, what would you do? Because on a preprint platform, it would be public. So I mean, that's not an easy situation to navigate.
No, it's not. I guess my own personal integrity would lead me to always say something if I know. How that plays out in practice with all with the politics that, you know, are a necessary part of business, I can't say. But at least in every instance that I've been aware of, you know, when I can say something, we've certainly posted, for example, preprints that I probably regretted posting ultimately, but didn't necessarily want to take them down or make them difficult to access because of that. But I do want people to know that there has been conversations about this by experts, and I want to draw people's attention to it. And I think this is an opportunity that we have that flexibility on our platform. We can say, yeah, this is being, you know, there is a PubPeer thread about this that people should reference. I think BioArchive is thinking in these terms as well, their new dashboard, pulling in, you know, not taking certainly not taking on the role of doing the assessments themselves on any level, but to the extent that those conversations are happening either through third parties, you know, through these other platforms, they should all be pointing back to the preprint. They should be attached to the preprint in some way. So we have the same goals on our platform. And even if that means that it's something going on at the journal article level, you know, whenever we can find it, we have a responsibility to push, you know, to push that through to the preprint. So I take that very seriously.
Okay, that's one of the things I really like about preprints. As a platform, they bring in more than any journal article I've ever read does. You can get your Bioarchive recently with their rejigged little thing they've got on their website now, which is much better than it used to be. You can now, you can click on, and if there's any public reviews, they're open up a little side pane, which a lot of the time, so if you take eLife, have their reviews at the end of an article or at the bottom, right on the left, and you've got to click it, and then it opens up somewhere else. And having them on the side, I actually use those, whereas I wouldn't if I've got to click on an extra button. And bringing everything together is so much better. And you've got more information on the article. It's great. I think they're all doing a great job.
And it speaks to the scientific article as a living document, and really reflects science, right? That's how science works. It's never, I think it was James Heathers on his podcast that said, you know, preprints are the opening of a door instead of the closing of one, but there was definitely a swear in there. And that's exactly it. And I know there's been debate about, I mean, there should be an end to it. You know, eventually you just call it done. You don't just keep iterating on that. But I don't know, there is a question about that. Like, definitely there are instances where scientists realize down the line that, you know, there's something needs to be corrected here. And we talked about it in X paper. And the idea that there really isn't a way, except through some really laborious like errata corrections through the journal to keep that conversation going, because those things are associated with, have a negative association with them as your retractions, right? Where, you know, there's a disincentive to correct the record on things. And should it be that way, or should we be embracing that, you know, this is just a part of science? It's so, you know, failure rate.
Yeah.
That's why I hated it. But we should allow space for that. How exactly to do that, I don't know. And I realize that that's a complicated question.
Yeah, but it is. It's just so nice to have it all there. And quite often, you know, if you've got the response to the reviews as well, there might be data in there that you would never otherwise see, because it's just a little graph for someone's question. But that could be the thing you need to then launch your next grant off, or solve the problem you've been having for years. And that might be a nice little way of being able to get in some of that negative data that we normally produce. And I mean, my last paper, quite a lot of the review responses had negative data in it. That would never have gotten out, but not only that, it is out. But yeah, no, I think it's a really good thing. I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about when they think of preprint. They just think of it speeding things up, which is the wrong way to think about it.
Yeah, agree.
Okay, that I think brings us quite nicely full circle. Well, thank you. That was great. I like these chats.
Great. I'm really, really pleased to have been invited to speak to you, and hope to do it again.
We'll be working our way back around. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more, and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.